Vincent Harding wants to make sure that Martin Luther King Day does not become an occasion to trivialize King's life and work, in the way we sometimes let our holidays make clichés of the great people and events the holidays were created to honor. Harding was the first director of the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta. He knew King from 1961 to 68. Harding was King's neighbor in Atlanta and worked with King in the Civil Rights Movement, leading workshops in nonviolent resistance. Now Harding is a writer and teacher. His books include The Other American Revolution and There is a River, The Black Struggle for Freedom in America. He is the former chair of the Department of History and Sociology at Spelman College and now is a professor at the Iliff School of Theology at the University of Denver. Harding doesn't want us to lose sight of the full scope of King's vision.
There is a temptation, and it's been a temptation ever since the first energies were put into trying to make this into a holiday. There's been a great temptation on the part of many people, for good and bad reasons, to smooth King off, to tame him down, to make him much more acceptable as a kind of a national figure. And I think that that's an understandable but an ill-advised sort of direction. My sense is that we have a choice now as a nation, really, that we can try to cut King down to our size, and we are in a rather narrow phase of our life now, with narrow expectations, with cautiousness as our guide, with an unwillingness to take major risks for new human initiatives. And King represented that lack of caution, represented that willingness to take risks, that willingness to go against the grain. And King, by the end of his life, was a very, very deeply criticized, harassed, surveyed man. He was accused by the government of being a communist dupe. He was accused by black people of deserting the black struggle. He was approved by the keepers of the conventional wisdom as being naive and out of his water. And he was in trouble in many ways because he had determined that what he had to do was to set his face towards particularly the issues of poverty in the society and how they could be addressed with courage and with outright strength, and the issue of this country's militarism and its paranoid anti-communism. So these were some of the kinds of things that Martin had decided he had to take on. These kinds of things are very rarely talked about as we approach the holiday. So I'm concerned that we will try to take the Martin who was ragged and rugged and rough and adventurous and courageous and try to smooth him off and make him into an acceptable national hero.
Do you think we've already started doing that?
To a great degree. When you have Mr. Reagan and Mr. Bush and lots of other misters and misses, now talking as if all that King was concerned about was, quote, prejudice in our society. And now they say, well, you know, we still have some prejudice, but we've gone a long way, and we're very happy that Martin King lived. No one talking about King's fundamental criticism of our foreign policy. No one talking about King's concern about materialism in American life, about the dangers of American capitalism in the way that it refuses to deal with the bottom rung of our society. No one raises those. My sense is that until we take on those rough edges of King and pick up his really large and overwhelming and frightening issues, we're not doing him justice and we're not doing ourselves justice as a nation.
My guest is Vincent Harding, who has written about Martin Luther King, and he's also the author of the book There is a River. He worked with Martin Luther King for about 10 years and was the first director of the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta. Did Martin Luther King have anything to do with your initially going south? You grew up in the North in Harlem. Did he have anything to do with your going south and joining the civil rights movement?
Now, directly, I would not say that King was the most direct inspiration. The thing that I remember most as Rosemary Harding and I, my wife and I, were talking about the South and talking about an invitation that came to us towards the end of 1960 to go South and to participate in the movement. The thing that was most on our mind was that we had been to one of those many meetings that was that were taking place in the North at that time, in which students and others from the freedom movement had come North, were reporting on what their experiences had been in the South, were singing the freedom songs, were moving people deeply. And my own recollection at this stage, 25 years later or more, is that it was their telling of their story and their singing of their songs and making that situation wherever they had been, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, doesn't make much difference right now, but they're making that very, very real and alive and making it a kind of first priority for this nation as a whole that began to grip us. King was a kind of figure, a presence, and certainly one had to see him as a sort of inspirational presence.
Civil rights or any kind of social change-oriented action is a lot easier to talk about than to really maintain a commitment to. Did he ever test you in any way to see how deep your commitment went and how much you were willing to sacrifice and how many risks you were willing to take to really see it through?
No, I never had any sense that he was doing that. I think he simply assumed that we would not have left the North and its, quote, relative safety to come South and to offer ourselves in what was essentially a kind of non-paying volunteer kind of capacity for a number of years unless there were some kind of commitment there. So I think that we hit it off very well from the outset, and I never felt that he felt any need for that kind of testing.
Did you yourself feel tested, though? I mean, were there times when you knew that this was going to be a turning point for you, that it was a potentially dangerous and frightening situation, and that you had the choice of either leaving for safety or of staying at great physical or personal risk?
Well, yeah, there were a number of occasions like that, but as we moved through the South and we operated all through the South and got to know a lot of the grassroots people, there was a sense in which we were now connected to a living community, as it were, scattered but very real. And so at times when there surely were the temptation to think that this is just getting too much, we were encouraged by these folks who had never left, who could never leave, and who would never leave. And we were also encouraged by the people who had come to have a certain faith and confidence in us. And so I think that, yes, there were times of testing like that, but it was terribly important to have a kind of living nexus, a living community of folks who almost literally held you to your commitment.
What was one of those times, though?
Well, an example would be in the midst of the Albany, Georgia campaign, when one of the most admired women in that community, the wife of the vice president of the Albany movement, who was pregnant at the time, was kicked and beaten by a sheriff when she went out to visit some people in jail. And the community was very angry. There was a tremendous possibility of explosion taking place there out of that justifiable anger. And Martin, at that particular point, was operating out of an injunction and had decided, at least temporarily, to observe the injunction and did not want to lead any kind of action. So he asked me if I would move away from the negotiating role at that point, because nonviolence was so important in the situation, if I would lead a group that would allow members of the community to express their concern by going down to the police station and standing there against the law, praying there against the law, and being ready to take whatever came on. And it was just one of those nights, and it was a nighttime thing, when it looked like half of the county and state troops in the area were there in town in Albany, Georgia. And it was a relatively small group of us, I think maybe 8 or 10 people, who decided that night to go down there and to make that kind of demonstration of protest against what had happened. And I remember, you know, feeling as we drove the car down to where we were going to park and then get out to go to the police station, you know, am I really going to walk into this? And where is this going to lead? But there were a number, especially of college-age young people who were with me. I was in my late 20s at the time, who were so clearly ready to go and who were so clearly expecting me to lead them that I simply had to go trembling. It's the way that we often remember that song that we used to sing, we are not afraid, we are not afraid. Well, we'd be singing, we're not afraid, but our knees would be practically buckling. But what it meant to us was that we will not allow our fears to overcome what we know is necessary and what we know must be done under the circumstances. And so that was one of the circumstances. And I was glad when it was done that it was done, and spent time in jail and felt very, you know, strengthened by that.
During that period in the South, you were in the position of having to introduce people to the concept of nonviolent direct action. It was a pretty new concept, and really it hadn't been practiced in the United States before it was in the civil rights movement. What were some of the ways you'd introduce the idea to people, and what were some of the reactions that you got?
Well, for one thing, we tried to make it very clear that what we were talking about was a way of struggling for truth and justice that required great courage and great strength, and that we did not want people who did not feel they had the courage to stand in the midst of whatever would come.
And I guess you didn't want people to think that you were asking them to be cowards and afraid
precisely,
to fight.
Precisely. No, we tried to redefine, and this is the way of classic nonviolent struggle. We tried to redefine what fighting was about. It was not fighting. It was fighting, choosing your own weapons rather than allowing yourself to be sucked into the weaponry of the opponent that you're struggling with. We tried as much as possible, and we didn't have to work very hard on this, because many black people in their wisdom there in the South saw what that kind of weapon love and that romance with the gun and that militarism of the South had done to so many white Southerners. That it had warped them and their values and their capacity to really be human. And so we tried to make clear to people that what we were trying to do was develop a way of struggle against that, which would use other approaches, which would challenge that. And one of the critical things that we felt we wanted to do was to find a way of struggle that everybody could participate in. You didn't have to be a big, strong, macho man to do it. You could be an 80-year-old grandmother. You could be a 12-year-old young woman. And you still, operating from the center of your own being, from the strength within you, you could stand up to Sheriff Clark. And you could be ready to go to jail and take whatever came on. So that kind of thing was very, very important. The other thing that we tried to help people to see was that in the Deep South, and of course this is one of the great differences between North and South again, but in the Deep South, so many of the black community, the overwhelming majority, were products of the black church and were deeply shaped by the whole Jesus story. And we could call upon the Jesus story of the one who fought against evil, but fought against evil by opening up his arms and by being absolutely strong, not backing down, but not taking the life of anyone else either, being willing to die rather than to kill for what you believe in. And the Jesus story and the Jesus example, very, very important as far as the Black community was concerned. So it was that gamut of things. And, of course, just the very, very what people call practical element that you try to pick up guns in South Carolina, Alabama, you are inviting precisely what those folks want you to do. And you are therefore offering no creativity to the struggle, and you're offering very little chance to your children as well.
Vincent Harding is my guest. We'll continue the interview after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Vincent Harding, who worked with Martin Luther King for about 10 years and was the first director of the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta. Was there any kind of training that you offered before demonstrations so that people would know some idea of how to behave?
Yeah, there was a lot of role-playing. I think that we were some of the original role-players in terms of the role-playing movement in our society. A lot of role-playing of how to deal with people on a verbal level, because one of the things that we were deeply concerned about was that at our best, we should be not simply people who acted in a certain way, but people who had a certain spirit as well, and who could communicate the spirit, a spirit which essentially said, I am not afraid of you, I am not going to back down to you, but I'm not going to hate you either. And we were trying to help people to develop that kind of capacity to be strong without being overcome by their justifiable anger and indignation under the situations. So we talked about spirit. We talked about how simply to handle themselves physically in situations where they would be beaten. And we talked constantly about how you act under provocation when people are clearly trying to provoke you in such a way that they have justification for shooting your head off.
What suggestions would you have for that when someone is trying to provoke you so that they have a reason to actually beat you or shoot you?
One of the things that we always were trying to do is make sure that people were operating in as much connection with others as possible, so that folks could encourage one another, so that they could remind one another, don't let them do that to you. Remember what we're here for. So we tried to encourage people, you know, to stand with one another. But of course, there was no guarantee that any of these things would work. I remember one workshop where Fannie Lou Hamer and two of her marvelous sisters were working on this kind of thing, and were leaving the workshop, a voter registration workshop, and going back to Mississippi. The workshop was in South Carolina. And so they found themselves in Winona, Mississippi, on the eastern edge of Mississippi, and decided that they were going to act out what they believed in. And they were taken into jail and beaten unmercifully. But Annell and Fannie Lou and June really just became even stronger in that situation. And I remember I wasn't there when they came out of the jail, but I was told that Annell's face was just terribly swollen up. When she came out from the beating, she could hardly speak. But when she saw her friends after she got out of jail, the first word she spoke was freedom. Now, that for me is an indication of the great strength of the human spirit. And what you do, of course, is that you recognize that as you are developing people and helping people and training people, that people are going to have to pay great price for freedom. And I think that, to go back to our beginning, that what we would like to do is to have a hero like Martin Luther King Jr. and forget the price that has to be paid still. But those folks kept reminding me that freedom comes only at great cost, and that we have to be prepared to pay the cost.
We have very high personal expectations of our political and social leaders, and you knew King on a personal level as well as on a working level. Was he able to, in personal relationships with friends and family, abide by the principles that he laid out for social change and for the civil rights movement Because you'd really have the impression of him having to be a saint from the actions that he carried out. And there are very few people, if any, who can really behave that way in their personal lives.
Well, I think, Terry, that in terms of any of our definitions, usual definitions of saint, Martin was not a saint. King, for me, is special in the sense that he is an illustration of what can happen with a person's life in spite of weaknesses. We would like to make people saints so that we will be excused from significant action by our weaknesses. And so we assume that they have none, and that's the reason why they were involved in significant action and choice-making. I think Martin takes away that kind of excuse from us. Martin had weaknesses. Martin had failings. Martin moved in situations where he made, at times, very poor decisions. In spite of that, Martin was able to keep getting up and keep moving in the direction that he had set his face. And I'll just mention a couple of kinds of things. King came out of a long tradition of the Baptist church in the black community. Very hierarchical tradition. On a certain level, very preacher-centered, one leader-centered. Martin always was conscious of that. He was not unconscious of that tradition. And he was conscious of the problems that that tradition carried, as well as the strengths it carried with it. And he had to deal with himself and with other people around the fact that more often than he would have liked and that some others would have liked, that kind of background came to the foreground. And Martin operated out of that individual leader sort of position. Unfortunately, there were a number of people around him who encouraged that. Here is the leader. Here is the one who's got the voice of the Lord. We will have to do whatever he says. You know, no major debate about this, et cetera, et cetera. Martin tried, I think, valiantly to overcome some of that, but often fell into that. That was a significant problem. And when you realize that this man came to be a world figure before he was 30 years old, I mean, you realize what a horrible burden that is to put on anybody. But under the circumstances, I thought that he handled himself reasonably well and tried to keep himself human. That was very difficult.
Were you totally shocked by his assassination, or did you thought that something like that was likely to happen in this country, which is so violent?
None of us who were any place nearby what was going on could be surprised. It is possible to be shocked simply because of what it does to your own being to lose a friend and coworker in that kind of way. But I certainly was not surprised in the sense that I didn't think it could happen, because Martin, at least from 1965 on, and in different ways pre-1965, the thought was that some folks from the white racist community would do something like that in some unexpected spot or situation. After King began dealing with Vietnam and the war, etc., and poverty and things of this sort, then more and more people began to see the possibility that there might be something much more organized and much more semi-official about the sites in which King was constantly kept. And so none of us were surprised in that sense. And Martin himself knew and constantly referred to the fact that he was living under the threat of death. He knew that. So he was not surprised. The surprising thing was that he insisted on going on, insisted on living in an open way, insisted on not being overprotected, and felt that he simply had to do what needed to be done, and he was prepared to take the consequences. Because he had come finally in his life, by the time 36, 37, 38 years old, where he had dealt with death and recognized that death was a real possibility for him and that it was therefore very important for him to keep living for what he believed in.
When we started the interview, you expressed your concerns that Martin Luther King Day might be subverted into a holiday where we think of King as being a nice, gentle, non-threatening man who, when in fact he posed a great threat to the way this country was being run.
Yes. The FBI said that he was the most dangerous Negro in America. I mean, there was no question about that.
What would you like to see Martin Luther King Day be?
I'd like us to try to spend as much time as possible looking at his agenda at the end of his life, asking ourselves, what were the things that he was most concerned about as his life ended, not at the March on Washington, but as his life ended, and then comparing that agenda with where we are now in the society, and all through the national community, taking a kind of a inventory of where we have gone since that time, forward or backwards, and then also taking a personal inventory as to what we're going to do about where we are now in the light of what his deepest concerns were.
Vincent Harding, I want to thank you very much for spending part of this day with us.
Good. Thank you, friend. Thank you.
Vincent Harding was the first director of the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta. Harding now is a professor at the Iliff School of Theology in Denver, Colorado. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.